This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
More schools around the country are emphasizing STEM education to help students get a head start in a world that is rapidly becoming more technology-driven. But with all that science and math, is there any room for creativity?
We have a vision of being an organization that is a leader in teaching the creative process from imagination to innovation.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about a group where imagination is the key to the destination. Then we'll hear about some nursing students who are helping new refugees in the U.S. navigate the healthcare system. And we'll also spend an academic minute with baby boomers who are having a little too much fun. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Students in the fields of STEM education and the fine arts often study the past innovations and creations of others without the chance to actually make something on their own. That's where Destination Imagination comes in. It's a volunteer-led nonprofit organization that develops opportunities to spark and inspire creativity in students. The Best of Our Knowledge's Patrick Garrett recently spoke with Stephen Turnipseed, the vice president of Destination Imagination, to find out about the group, its mission, and the way it inspires young people.
Destination Imagination is a not-for-profit. We are celebrating, I think, probably our 33rd year in existence, and we have a vision of being an organization that is a leader in teaching the creative process from imagination to innovation. The way we do this is through creating challenges. These challenges are sent out at the beginning of an academic year, and these challenges focus in a variety of areas. For example, a technical challenge or a scientific challenge or an improvisation challenge, a service learning challenge, that sort of thing. There's seven challenges that are produced, and they go out at the beginning of the academic year, and then teams are formed, and it's a hierarchical process. We have regional and state and country level competitions, and it's a K through university program. As the children engage in these various challenges, they come up with creative solutions. And as they move from regionals to state levels, then there's also a global final, which is held in May, which is the largest celebration of student creativity in the world. We have about 10,000 kids there with 1,400 teams. And so we give them the opportunity to compete there. And whoever has the most innovative solutions at three different grade levels is crowned our winner in the event, which is sort of the payoff for the children, for the adults involved, and for the underlying mission that we have of creating in children the ability to be successful in the 21st century. They've acquired these so-called 4C skills: creativity, critical thinking and problem solving, collaboration, communication. They have learned how to take a project, come up with new ideas, implement that project using project management skills, working with a budget. So we're basically giving them the career and life skills that they're going to need to be successful in an ever-changing world.
So what makes these skills different from, say, when either of us went to school?
When we went to school, we are part of an educational process, an educational system that was created in an industrial era, and its primary focus was to impart a body of knowledge, a body of memorized content. And it was mostly about having memorized the content and how to use that content in applied ways, mathematics, science, the arts, things like that. And then when we left high school or university, we normally would go out into the workforce, and we could engage in a profession and a job that would likely last more or less the same way over a very long career. The process skills, that is to say, the skills of how do you think creatively? What does it mean to be creative? What does it mean to think critically about something? What exactly does that mean? And how do you work in teams? And how do you communicate your ideas? Those were normally not taught directly throughout the core curriculum. Certainly they were picked up in our generations. They were picked up in after-school activities. They were picked up sometimes in things like the National Speech and Debate Association, for example, for communication, and athletics for some of the team functions. But there was nothing intentional about it. It was more of a process where we caught it rather than we were taught it. With destination imagination, we have a level of intentionality. We have what's called a roadmap that every child goes through that teaches them the core processes around what does it mean to be creative and what is the creative process? What does it mean to think critically? What exactly is that different from thinking non-critically, for example? And we carry them through that learning process in a very intentional way. And that's really the big difference, is that we have an intentionality about learning these so-called 21st century skills, which is different than what you would have seen in the normal, in fact, what we see in today in normal core content delivery in school.
Would you say that this new style of learning is any bit related to the new Common Core standards?
Within the Common Core, when the Common Core came into existence, it was moving from more or less an inquiry-based type of environment to a engineering process-based environment. So what you see embedded in the Common Core is a series of engineering processes. And these engineering processes, by definition, include this notion of critical thinking, creativity, collaboration, communication. And there's a certain intentionality in the Common Core. I would hasten to point out, however, that the Common Core is nothing more than a framework that defines the desired outcomes of an educational experience. It does not necessarily define the type of curriculum. So we've been around for over 30 years, long before the Common Core came into existence. The way of learning is being stimulated in a significantly greater way by the children themselves recognizing that when they have the Library of Congress sitting on their hip with their smartphone, that memorizing content is probably not going to be their way forward. In fact, by some estimates, 65% of the jobs that a child entering school today will have access to have not been created yet. They'll be solving problems that have not been thought of yet, using tools that have not been invented yet. And this will happen every 3 to 5 years. So children will have to have process skills in far greater abundance and usefulness than perhaps people, certainly of my generation, coming out of the very traditional world, educated in the 50s and 60s, to the types of things that we see with children that are being educated today.
Now, as I understand it, you have a global finals event coming up for students who have had success on the local level tournaments. Would you mind explaining exactly what is going on at the global finals?
Well, the global finals is, I will try to do it justice in words, but I will hasten to point out that the global finals is such an experiential event that it's very, very difficult to put it all into words, but let me try it like this. The Global Finals is certainly a venue at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville where we bring together all of these teams that have won their state and country levels. They come from 48 states and 30 countries. They will come together and we begin the day, we begin the event, if you will, with an opening ceremony, which is a celebration of the diversity of the children and a celebration of the accomplishment of the creative process. It has a highly creative component to it. It's, if you can imagine, 10,000 kids, 7,000 adults all in an arena. It's loud, it's exciting, it's high energy. And then from there, these young people compete in competitive events with appraisers. We don't call them judges. We call them appraisers, who appraise not to subtract points, but appraise on the basis of adding points because you've accomplished a certain level or a certain skill or a certain outcome in a predefined rubric. We train our appraisers very, very well so that we have uniformity. And they go through this competitive process, which culminates in the closing ceremonies and the announcement of the final winners, which comes on Saturday. Now, during the process of this global finals, when children are not competing, what are they doing? Well, children are, and young people, are involved in what we call pen trading. They all come with custom designed pens and they trade these pens with each other. We have a expo which is populated by name brand companies that are showcasing innovation, newest innovations, newest ideas. We have workshops for the children to attend where they learn skills like design skills, acting skills, learn skills that are related to space or to energy and these types of things. to help them be better in being able to solve these challenges that they see year after year. Because we encourage children to engage, since it is nominally a pre-K to university event, we encourage them to come back year after year after year. And as they do, they get better and better and better, as you can well imagine. And over the course of time, you see people who have been in it, for example, from kindergarten through their 12th grade. When they graduate, you're talking about incredibly capable young people who are deeply educated, deeply ingrained in these various processes, in these various abilities. And all of this is happening at this global final. So it's a huge celebration. It's fun, with a capital F-U-N, fun, for everyone there. It's energy absorbing and energy generating. And it's something where the entire city of Knoxville is taken over by Destination Imagination. And we include not only our children and our young people in the event internally, we include the community, and we have a service learning component, which we engage in while we're there. So it gives children not only the skills, but it gives them the experience and the mentors and the role models for how to be a good global citizen and a good global member of society.
Where do the students go afterwards? Do you have any like high-profile alumni?
There are a number of alumni, and many of them are high-profile. I would have to get a list of the names, but we have actors, we have people that are prominent in space industry, we have people that are prominent in education, in all facets of the STEM world.
Still to come, Patrick Garrett's conversation with Stephen Turnipseed, the vice president of Destination Imagination, continues with a look at some of the big-name supporters of the organization. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Stephen Turnipseed, the vice president of Destination Imagination. It's a nonprofit group that works to inspire creativity in young people through STEM education. He's talking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Patrick Garrett.
So you do have at the global finals some high-profile sponsors and exhibitors that I imagine some of them have actually gone on to probably even work and maybe even show up at the event. Why bring in the big names like, say, NASA?
Couple of reasons. One is that these big names recognize that these young people have skills that they need for their successful future pipeline of employees. We are very often approached by large premium brands to be in our expo because they know that these are the kinds of young people that will ultimately become their employee pipeline, and they're the kind of people they want to hire. They're the people with the learning skills, the process skills, the ability to engage and reinvent themselves, and they see it in real time. The other thing that they do is they want to showcase what they're doing. They want to be a part of the world of the children, the culture of the children, so that they begin to see, as they become consumers, how important this is. And for someone like NASA, for example, it's not only a potential recruitment arena, but it's also an arena to carry children's imagination to a beyond global level and emphasize the profound need that we have to think about and learn about the world around us. We have National Geographic, for example. We have Disney. We have 3M. We have top names who recognize that the more expansive and creative young people are, the more successful we will be as a nation and as a global community in solving the grand engineering challenges that do face us and will continue to face us throughout the future.
I just have one last follow-up question to build on a question that we had earlier. As I understand, Destination Imagination has teamed up with Oracle Academy and the White House to offer coding programs across the nation. And I remember learning cursive writing, and that's something I've still yet to really use. So why is coding important to today's youth, and what makes it everlasting?
Well, that's an outstanding question, and we have to start a little bit by stepping back and saying, what exactly is coding? Most people don't necessarily know what coding is, but in the context of what we're doing here, what we're really talking about is being able to teach a machine how to function, create the software, write the software in the various languages that we have. And there's a much deeper definition to coding, but the broad definition is allowing the individuals to engage with machines in such a way that they can teach machines and they can tell machines how to perform certain activities. One of the big reasons why this is such a huge demand today is that by the end of this decade, there will be about 9.5 to 10 million STEM-based jobs, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics jobs. And almost half of those jobs will be in the area of software development, will be in the area of coding. So we need people who can directly code in order to fill that huge job demand. We also need to have children who and young people who understand how to write simple software and how to interface with software and with machine, speaking to machines, if you will, in such a way that they can phrase questions correctly. You may be familiar with some of the new devices that are out there that you can talk to, the Siri of iPhone, the Alexa of Amazon. These are our cloud-based interactions with machines. And in order to communicate with that machine, you actually have to ask the question in the right way. You have to code the question. So it becomes a gateway course to our gateway understanding for young people to develop critical thinking. How do you think logically? How do you communicate with a machine so that you actually get what you want? And frankly, it's a jobs issue and an economic issue. We have got to prepare the future workforce and the consumer base for a highly, highly technical world. And the starting place is coding. This is well recognized by the White House with their support, and certainly with Oracle with their support of our coding challenges.
Stephen Turnipseed is the Vice President of Destination Imagination. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Patrick Garrett. You can learn more at destinationimagination.org. Starting a new life is not an easy thing to do for the nearly 70,000 refugees that enter the U.S. each year. They face challenges like language and cultural barriers, and for some, navigating the complexities of the healthcare system. So a group of nursing students in mid-Missouri are working with new refugees to help them become self-sufficient, one appointment at a time. Rebecca Smith for Side Effects Public Media reports from Columbia, Missouri.
Lawlin Liana walks up to the receptionist desk at his doctor's office. He signs in, gives his name and address, and pays a small copay. But standing just behind him, off to the side, are two nursing students from the University of Missouri who are there to help Liana if he needs help communicating with the receptionist or filling out forms.
We're going to guide them, and so maybe the first time we'll help them basically talk to the people in front desk.
That's Stone Chen. He and his partner, Emily Nguyen, are working with Liana and other refugees as part of a health navigator program started by fellow nursing students 2 years ago.
As more appointments they go, we're going to let them speak to the front desk, let them call the interpreters. We'll be there to guide them, watch them.
This help can be invaluable for refugees trying to adjust to a new life. Like for Liana, at the time of this appointment, he'd only been in the U.S. for a month.
1 month only.
He's originally from Myanmar, but for the past several years, he and his family have been living in a refugee camp because of political unrest. Now, making it to the doctor for a checkup can be especially important for refugees. According to the Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement, refugees face more health issues such as tuberculosis, diabetes, hypertension, post-traumatic stress disorder, and depression.
Refugees are a whole another level of need because they have so many more extra vulnerabilities.
That's Megan Gore, the Refugee Health Coordinator for Refugee and Immigration Services in Mid-Missouri. She says the office of 7 employees serves about 150 new refugees a year. And refugee caseworkers,
they're definitely exhausted, you know, and then they get the houses set up. They get the Social Security and food stamps and initial primary care appointment. And most of the time, yeah, they're just able to take them to the appointment and then pick them back up.
So this is where nursing students step in to fill the gap, taking refugees through the entire process of a doctor's visit. But Chen is clear. This is more than just hand-holding.
I think the best way to learn is you do it yourself. With the refugees, if we just do everything for them and every time, then they, in a way, become dependent on us. And the more work for us, it doesn't help them grow, doesn't help them survive.
So the students stand back and let the refugees do it on their own.
We're trying to promote self-sufficiency.
Megan Gore from Refugee and Immigration Services says the nursing students have helped a lot since creating the program. In 2014 alone, nursing students, volunteers, and case managers partnered to cover 130 health appointments. In fact, Gore says the program is working so well, she, along with others, are working to create a more sustainable position, a refugee health advocate.
We need to have a more advanced position where students actually go in to appointments. They keep track of case notes. They do follow-ups.
And while the nursing students are volunteering through their community health class, it goes beyond that. Emily Nguyen says it's helping her become a better nurse by making her more conscious of other people's challenges.
It's been a pretty good experience just to change my care, like as a nurse, just to realize that everyone comes from a different place and has their own barriers to deal with, like along with like language barriers and cultural barriers. Just like seeing the person as a person and not like a refugee or a race.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Rebecca Smith.
They say the baby boomer generation was all about having fun. Well, apparently that's still true, and they're not being all that safe about it. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
HIV cases in people over 50 are on the rise. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Eileen Warner-Marin, clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, explains why older adults may not appreciate the risks as much as the younger generation.
Last year, the CDC announced an astonishing figure. 50% of all HIV/AIDS cases in the U.S. involve people over 50, although the majority of that group has aged with HIV since the advent of highly active antiretroviral therapy. About 17% of them had the virus transmitted when they were older. What makes older adults vulnerable to HIV? The main issue is the lack of understanding about the risk. Many people over 50 remember using condoms to avoid pregnancy, but may not consider being at risk for HIV or other STDs, issues that were not a concern as they were coming of age. Many older people consider HIV as an infection that affects the young, the poor, IV drug users, or gay men, and don't see themselves as being at risk if they don't fit in to any of those categories. But the virus does not discriminate against age and can be transmitted more easily to a postmenopausal woman because of micro tears from inadequate lubrication. The greatest issue in older adult transmission is the lack of dialogue between them and their providers. Prescribing ED medications without discussing safe sex practices or assuming monogamy prevents patients from engaging in a conversation about what personal preventative strategies are needed. Healthcare providers must ask every patient, "Do you need any information about safe sex?" Not all patients will need to have this conversation, but asking the question opens the door in a safe, non-judgmental way.
That was Eileen Warner-Marin of the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.